My guest today, again, is Pat Ferenga, here to discuss the second half of the Harvard Post-Pandemic Future of Homeschooling Conference. Welcome back, Pat.
Hey, Blake. Thanks for having me.
So, were you totally riveted by the second half of this conference?
Well, the child abuse thing certainly got my attention, and I was quite relieved to finally get the skinny on all the data collection. Everyone's always talking about, oh, there's no data about homeschooling, and now we learn there's no data about school abuse or private school abuse. And
that all seems to be the theme of this entire conference. There's no data. Just we don't know anything. We're going to be talking about that in a moment. And then after that, we are also going to talk about a separate Harvard conference regarding homeschooling. This is the Homeschooling Summit, which was supposed to happen in person in June 2020. And it was postponed due to COVID. And then it happened this June, actually concurrently with the post-pandemic conference. We're trying not to confuse these two conferences. One is the Harvard Post-Pandemic Future of Homeschooling Conference. That's what we've been discussing. And this other one, which was a private invitation-only online conference, let's call it the Summit. And that was organized by Elizabeth Barthelet and James Dwyer, who we talked about in the previous episode. They appeared in the first week of the post-pandemic conference. And so I got a secret invitation to this online conference. I was sworn to secrecy because when they discussed it last year, there was a lot of pushback and a lot of potential disruption that was being brought forth by the homeschooling community, probably for good reason. And so I attended that conference, and we'll be talking about that in the second half of this episode. So stick around to hear about the secret Harvard Homeschooling Summit and everything that was brought up there. Okay, but back to the post-pandemic conference. There were 3 weeks that happened in the second half of this conference. The first one was asking, is there more abuse in homeschooling or in public school? The next one was, is homeschooling an international movement? And the last session was a panel of homeschooling parents, which we probably won't spend much time discussing. So let's go back to, is there more abuse in homeschooling or in public school? What stood out to you about this session, Pat?
Well, I was, first of all, relieved to hear that while there was not a lot of data about homeschoolers, and as I said earlier, and then they said the same thing, you know, is true of schools. And, you know, they talked about the difficulties of lining up, you know, police reports and children in need of services reports and school reports, and how it's impossible. There's nothing there that they can really use. So they have to extrapolate in other ways. But I was really glad to hear that, you know, based on their extrapolation of enrollment figures of people who are deciding to homeschool and the increase in homeschooling over the last 20 years or so, I think they even may have gone back further. And while the rise of homeschooling was, you know, numbers of people homeschooling increased, reports of child abuse and so on did not increase, you know, among the homeschooling community at that time. And so there's, you know, no evidence that homeschooling causes an increase in child abuse. One of the things that really stuck out at me, though, especially if you've read the book Educated by Tara Westover, and that is that physical abuse takes place in families, to keep children in line or whatnot. Domination sort of tactics, but that sexual abuse is most often done by non-family members. So, you know, sending them to schools and camps and stuff, you know, those are, you know, you do want to make sure that those people are vetted properly, you know? And so that I think, you know, I don't think it's going to assuage a lot of critics, but, you know, at the same time, for me, it like puts to rest like this idea of, you know, parental predators of their on their children, and you know that's why they want to homeschool. I mean, you know, there's always going to be some horrible case that comes out, you know, one way or the other. But you know, horrible for the schools or horrible for homeschoolers. But overall, statistically, what they're saying is it's not an issue, nothing to worry about.
So, I guess I am not totally convinced by the arguments put forth in this session. I'm really glad that this was an entire session, because this is one of the most important kind of counter critiques, is saying, okay, homeschooling is not perfect, but what's the alternative? What goes on in public schools in terms of potential abuse? That's an important discussion. I just felt like the evidence that was presented here was super weak, and it essentially said nothing. First of all, like you, I was surprised that there's just not that much data. And the one study that was cited was from 2002, or the study was 2003, but the data was 2002. And that said that essentially 9.6% of public schoolers from K to 12 experience some form of unwanted educator sexual misconduct. And this could be either physical or non-physical. So non-physical could be something like someone sending you lewd text messages. And so, you know, that's pretty old data, and it's pretty shocking that there hasn't been any new studies about this. Like, really? Can that possibly be true? It's been 20 years since there's been any systematic review of like abuse in public schools. The evidence that was provided by I believe Angela Dills, it just didn't really make sense to me, because the comparison was, all right, let's look at the total number of child fatalities, not including car crashes, let's compare the years before major homeschooling legislations were enacted in the 80s and 90s to the years after that. Like, that's painting with such a broad brush. And she even said herself, and the moderator reinforced this, that, you know, we might be capturing too much data, we might be capturing too little data. There's a very low sample size. We're also only talking about reported cases. And the results, she said herself, were not statistically significant. And so, again, the theme of this conference is we don't know. There's not good data. You know, so I just didn't feel that convinced that anything meaningful was said here about whether there is a link between child abuse and homeschooling. Just that this one study based on the 80s and 90s, like this is almost a generation ago now. I just didn't find it very compelling.
Well, I was just happy for the headline.
Oh, what? Which headline?
That, you know, it shows that child, you know, statistically, you know, you're not going to find more child abuse in homeschool if more people homeschool.
The statistics were not significant. So I don't know. It just feels like a giant question mark to me.
Well, I'm glad. I know, but they could have put the question mark the other way too. You know, that's why I'm saying I'm happy for the headline.
Yeah, well,
we don't have enough data, so we really have to press hard on these homeschoolers to get it. You know,
what I did like in this session was that many of the researchers said that, you know, that a likely reason that there's not more research about abuse that goes on in schools is that schools exist and teachers' unions exist to protect the jobs and reputations of the adults who work there. And that makes sense to me.
Yeah. And that was a really incredible and well put point made by, I forget her last name, but Cheryl, was her name?
Or Carol Shakeshaft.
Yes. And, you know, she made a closing statement that was quite powerful on that, you know, and I really appreciated it, how children are just not believed. You know, and these situations. And so institutional concerns, as we've seen with the Catholic Church and, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, they, you know, and God knows how many private schools, you know, have buried such cases mm-hmm. over the decades. You know, so I'm really glad that was spoken by somebody.
One other thing that came up in this session was the moderator said, so how do we protect protect kids or minimize the chance of abuse? And he brought up one of the suggestions from the very first session about requiring homeschoolers to have 2 annual visits to mandatory reporters, to adults mm-hmm. outside of the family. And one of the presenters, Angela, responded, which I think is a pretty common response, this is like saying you're guilty until you're proven innocent, and that any rules that apply to homeschoolers should also apply to public schoolers. And I mm-hmm. definitely agree with that sentiment. But also at the same time, I thought, well, this would be a universally applied rule because public schoolers are seeing mandatory reporters, you know, teachers or other adults there 5 days a week. And so 2 annual visits to mandatory reporters is, you know, that's certainly equal treatment. It's still quite unequal. Just if you're talking about gross amount of time spent in front of non-parental adults. And I think we're going to return to the subject later in this episode, Pat, but what do you make mm-hmm. of that?
Well, what is a mandatory reporter? You know, I mean, what's their duty? I mean, in a school, you know, they got 30 kids or 20 in the classroom and so on, you know, and then you're talking about a homeschooling family that has a mandatory reporter come and sit in their living room, visit the home and, you know, examine things. I mean, right there, there's a qualitative difference in how this is conducted.
Yeah, I think also you could go outside of the home and go see a pediatrician or... I don't know.
Yeah, but that's something different, you know. And I know that. And again, we're coming into the second conference here.
Yeah, that's
really
right.
Going to depths in this, so maybe we should hold off on going in detail.
All right, we'll table that. We'll come back.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so let's move on to the next session, which was: is homeschooling an international movement? And mm-hmm. I was really hoping that there was going to be someone who would present an overview of the state of homeschooling legalities all across the world. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. We heard from presenters in Israel, France, mm-hmm. and Quebec about mm-hmm. their specific situations, which were all interesting, mm-hmm. but
right.
Yeah.
Right.
A bit disappointing. It was.
The French researcher was so proud of, you know, the fact that they've captured the data. That cracked me up, you know, that was, and I think it was like 4,600 families or something that they can absolutely say were homeschoolers in France, and these are their test scores and whatnot. But yeah, it would have been nice to hear more, because I'm so aware. I mean, as are you, because you probably more so as you travel far more than I do. But homeschooling is—I get inquiries from all over the place, you know. And I don't know the laws in 99% of these countries. And it would have been really interesting to hear how other countries regulated. And also the whole thing in France. I mean, he kind of touched on it, but mm-hmm. I was surprised that didn't get more mention. You know, I mean, they're on the cusp of banning homeschooling, and because of the protests of homeschoolers, they've come up with some other arrangement, you know. But
my understanding, based upon what was his name, Philip, said in the conference, was that as of October 2020, there's a new policy that will be implemented in September 2022. So there's like a 2-year lead time here, in mm-hmm. which you must apply for authorization to homeschool. And so this is essentially Elizabeth Barthelet's presumptive ban on homeschooling mm-hmm. being enacted. And mm-hmm. even right now, they already have home inspections and mandatory registration. Yep. And, you know, it's much more highly regulated, but it's going to mm-hmm. move in this direction of, guilty until proven innocent.
So. Yeah. And these are families, you know. I mean, what's interesting to me, though, and again, like, you know, the devil's in the details, right? So they say, oh, yeah, you have to meet with an evaluator or mandatory reporter or something like that. Well, in France, they do that. And my understanding is that the person who interviews you or your children, or I imagine it's more the children, is the town mayor.
Really?
In France.
The mayor? Yeah,
that's what, and maybe this is only in like the more rural parts of France.
But, that is hilarious in this sad kind of way.
I know, right? You go in, you meet with the mayor, and okay, you can homeschool.
It's like saying, I'm going to open a restaurant. Who's going to do the food safety inspection? The dog catcher. Like,
yeah, and he's also, yeah, exactly. It's just like, okay, can you read this passage? All right, but, and again, when we get to the bigger thing, the secret conference, we'll have more to say on this. But one of the interesting things that the French researcher said was that 50% of homeschoolers only homeschool for a year or less. Mm-hmm. In France. And, you know, I've seen, I believe that in America, it's 3 years, 2 to 3 years before, most people stop homeschooling.
Okay.
But, you know, we have, homeschooling has always been a short-term solution for some people. But as you know, a lot of people start with short-term in mind and wind up sticking with it, mm-hmm. you know? So I wonder in France, it's so different. Than America, their conception of democracy and stuff. So it's, I'm sure that the culture has a big difference, but I'd really like to know, like, why 50% of homeschoolers, stop after first year? Is it just that France is so hostile that there's so few options, lack of support groups or what, that's an interesting, and then 75% after 2 years, he said. So yeah, that would be interesting to find out why it doesn't mm-hmm. have the legs that, certainly we've seen families in Britain and America have.
One other thing that stood out to me, the presenter from Quebec said that there's been a big influx of homeschoolers in recent years, especially among ultra-Orthodox Jewish families.
And, yes.
I don't know if there was further explanation there, but
no, there wasn't.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that just stood out. And this mm-hmm. makes me think, one of the big reasons that they're changing the homeschooling laws in France is because they're concerned about religious separatism among Islamic
families. Right, parallel societies.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, mm-hmm. We definitely have our own version of that here in the US, but it definitely seems like more of a kind of very pressing concern in France. And mm-hmm. and I wonder if something like that is going to happen in Quebec also. There's a lot of people who are concerned about, highly insulated communities. And I think ultra-Orthodox Jews definitely fall into that mm-hmm. description. So like you said, it's a very culturally specific thing that we're describing here. It's not like everyone mm-hmm. just equally believes in the goodness of homeschooling. People have specific concerns about the unintended consequences of letting families right. really do their own thing.
But what was very interesting to me is when Dr. Brabant, the quote from Quebec, said that Quebec has had homeschooling as a legal practice since 1943.
Yeah, right?
I thought that was pretty fascinating, and yet they're still arguing about it. It's regulation.
Yeah. All of the presenters painted a picture of fairly highly regulated homeschooling. And I wish we had heard from representatives from like the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, mm-hmm. Other provinces of Canada. There are a lot of places where you can homeschool in a fairly unregulated way, closer to the U.S. right. model.
Mm-hmm.
The
other thing that was two other things that I thought Dr. Brabant made that caught my ears was the way she categorized homeschool regulations. Instead of saying most restrictive to least restrictive, she used more qualitative terms, which I thought was an interesting way to approach it. But then she pointed out that there's this whole new profession in Quebec, homeschool inspectors.
That's right. Home education monitor. That's what I wrote down.
Home ed monitors. Right.
Pat, maybe you and I are qualified for a job in Canada if we decide we want to start a new life somewhere. Probably not, yeah. Though. You'd probably just, you know, because she also mentioned that they have to follow the state curriculum. And
I was going to say, yeah. And then, you know, the Swiss have such a thing, the education counselors, I think she said they call them. Yeah.
So maybe you and I would not be good fits for that job.
Probably not, you know, because so much of it is this idea of, you know, fitting round pegs into square holes, you know. It's like, yeah, it's like, no, you know, like, let's let everyone find their own way of learning, their own, you know, and have patience with us. But as we'll see as we move into the next conference, there's very, very little patience for this. It's like, you know, things must be done.
So would you summarize for listeners what took place in the final session, the panel of homeschooling parents?
Yeah, the homeschooling panel of parents was wonderful. But as someone who's been in the 80s and 90s was a parent on these such panels and also convened them and ran them. And you could even see YouTube videos of some of these panels, like for the Colfax family from a conference we did in the late 90s, you know, it's almost what they're saying is, you know, the same, you know, things haven't changed. I mean, it's wonderful. You know, you have highly structured families that are able to get the curriculum out of the way and then let the kids do what they want to do later on in the day. You got your unschooling families, you have your libertarian family that thinks all education should be private, you know, and everyone's was eloquent. They addressed, they made their points well. And you know, to me, it was, I've heard this before and this is good, but you know, when I was listening, Paul Peterson, I think is his name, you know, the moderator was wrapping things up, you know, and he was wonderful. He did a great job, I thought, of keeping it all evenly balanced and asking some very good probing questions. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, he was saying how nice it is to hear from the parents and how enlightening and stuff. And part of me felt like, well, maybe we should have led with the parents.
You know,
started the conference with that, you know, and again, like I said, that to me was the least surprising, because it just confirmed what I've seen for 40 years at homeschooling events.
If you've ever been to a homeschooling conference, this was like a standard, maybe not standard, because they chose a fairly ideologically diverse group of parents. You know, you had the military mom who was like definitely school at home, high performance, and you know, all the way out to unschoolers and everything in between. So yeah, I agree. That should have been first.
I know, sort of set the plate, but you know, they did set the tone, you know, with this research thing, and you know, and I appreciated that over time. You know, at first I was, oh gosh, here we go. They're gonna throw every test score and study at us, you know, based on school. And going back to the international notes, I had a note here, you know, Albert Cheng, who was the moderator, we should have more humility and a posture of learning from one another. And I thought that was, you know, really good. And then he made a comment about, I believe it was him, about how all these ideas are like John Dewey's, you know, learning by doing, getting the children involved in society. It was describing unschoolers, basically, you know, but giving credit to Dewey. And I was like, wait, that's John Holt. You know, yeah, Dewey preceded Holt, but Holt said, take them out of school. Dewey actually homeschooled his kids for a year, I understood. I understand. He took them out of school to try it, you know. Of course, it wasn't called homeschooling then, I respect Dewey's ideas, and I've read Democracy in America and some other shorter things of his. So there's definitely an alignment, but it really cracks me up when they cite these things like, here, the goal of public school is described by John Dewey is best described by these homeschoolers and unschoolers.
So everyone, if you enjoyed our summary of this post-pandemic future of homeschooling conference and you want to go back and like see the primary source, you want to see what the research that was presented, you can do all of that by going to the website for this conference. The videos are all uploaded there. You can verify that Pat and I, you know, made a meaningful summary and analysis of this conference. I'll make sure to put the link to that in the episode notes.
Mm-hmm.
Great. All right. Well, we did it. Now there's only one other thing to discuss, Pat.
The secret conference.
So it's not that secret. As I mentioned in the beginning, this was supposed to be a real life conference that was going to happen in June 2020. And for obvious reasons, it did not happen. They postponed it for a full year. And I think I'm still not exactly clear why I got invited to the conference. I'm pretty sure it's because I had Elizabeth Barthelet, James Dwyer, and Rachel Coleman on my podcast back in early 2020. And I think they enjoyed those conversations enough to invite me because I was definitely kind of an outlier in this conference. It was not, apparently there's about 80 or 90 people attending it. It was not possible to see who the other attendees were. There were a few kind of discussion sections that you could optionally join, and maybe 20 or 30 people joined after the main sessions. And so I got to have a little taste of who is attending this conference. And it was definitely more academics and child welfare advocates and people from, you know, from the legal profession. This was not people like me or like you, Pat. This is not like a lot of people with deep personal experience regarding homeschooling or, God forbid, unschooling. Although there were in attendance a number of people who are associated with the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, the CRHE, and a number of grown homeschoolers who had pretty similar and kind of tragic tales of how they were neglected in their families. And we'll talk about that. So that was the closest thing to, you know, intimate experience with, you know, homeschooling and homeschoolers that existed here. So this is definitely a conference for academics, for litigators. And they made it very clear from the beginning that this is more than just a conference to share ideas. This is a conference to discuss action and, you know, actions that could severely regulate and restrict the a parent's ability to homeschool, a kid's ability to be homeschooled or unschooled. But before we jump into this, Pat, I want to ask you a question. And this is based on, you know, they say you should never read the comment section, or you should never like read the reviews of something that you put out there. Well, every once in a while I look at reviews, and someone reviewed my podcast and said, "Great podcast, but why did you give Elizabeth Barthelet a platform? This lady wants to essentially ban homeschooling. And, you know, you gave her a chance to speak her ideas." And I was a bit taken aback by that comment. And I wonder how many other people think like, "All right, Blake, what are you doing talking with these people who want to regulate and, you know, highly restrict homeschooling? Why are you hanging around with them? Why are you discussing them? Shouldn't you just be ignoring them?" I don't know how many people think that, but what do you think, Pat?
Well, I think we need to engage, especially if someone's attacking you. You should figure out like why, you know. Certainly, you know, at these early stages, you know, this is where dialogue would be. Or at least trying some sort of dialogue's impossible. Just trying some sort of arrive at some understanding of why they feel this way, and what you can do. I mean, to just ignore it and put your head in the sand is not a smart move, especially when it's coming from a place like Harvard that's got connections all over the place, the public school system and government. You know, so heads up, pay attention, and let's hear what they have to say. And, you know, looking at your notes, I was not at this event. I'm obviously too toxic for this topic for these folks. But at the same time, you know, Blake, you did a great job with your notes. I mean, you know, excellent. And so I've got a good feeling of what the 3-day event was like. And yeah, I don't see why we need to be scared about talking about these things, you know. And so it's like I've said to you on other topics. I'm really disturbed, you know, that we can't, like, you know, on the one hand, people say, oh, you shouldn't even talk about these topics. It's like, well, that's how child abuse keeps getting perpetrated, you know. And we have to figure, you know, we do have to talk about these things, and we do have to address them. But we have to do it from a position of being informed. And you know, Bartholet largely came at it from, you know, the book Educated, and then trying to spin that out to other, you know, things for her presumptive ban on homeschooling in that initial article that she put there. And why, you know, we need, you know, she didn't engage. I mean, she sort of just threw the gauntlet down to the homeschooling community. It's not like, you know, there was any effort to reach out to the community. It's just like, oh, you guys are doing something terrible, and I think it should be banned. Because she's got this position of power, everyone's got to, you know, listens to her, you know, and so we have to pay attention to this. So, I have no problem talking with her, and I applaud you for having the nerve and the wherewithal to do it.
Well, thanks for that perspective. And I definitely agree that if someone's going to come after something that you hold dear, something that you cherish, and Pat, you and mm-hmm. I definitely cherish the freedoms to homeschool in your own way that we have in the United States. Yeah. You know, definitely seek to understand their positions, because if you're going to defend yourself, then you should at minimum be highly informed about the positions mm-hmm. that your opponents are going to take. And then you should also, I believe, you know, keep your mind open in some fundamental way. And maybe your mind will be changed a little
bit. That's right.
And I think holding that position, you're much more likely to possibly change the mind of the people who are on the other side. So
absolutely.
So that's the spirit mm-hmm. in which we move forward here, is mm-hmm. trying to understand, keep open minds while still defending the things we hold dear, and trying to change other people's minds at the same time. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me just share what I heard and observed and what I reacted to in this conference, the summit. So it was 3 days, June 9th, 10th, and 11th, 2021, 4 hours each day, plus these optional kind of extra things afterwards. And, oh boy, where to even start here? Those notes that you mentioned, Pat, I have made these notes public, and this is totally fine with Harvard's Child Advocacy Program, which is Elizabeth Bartholet's program. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have any problem with me publishing these, and so I will also share notes to these raw notes, share the link to these raw notes in this episode description, so you can go check this out yourself. Mostly what stood out to me is that, just like in the first session of the post-pandemic conference, there were two large concerns voiced by these people who are essentially fighting for the rights of children and the welfare of children. That's their concern. They said, we want to protect the subset of homeschoolers who are potentially abused in these really horrific ways. We are also concerned about the broader educational and civic nature of homeschooling. And so I see it as a sort of two-pronged focus. One is about, like, pretty raw abuse, maltreatment, neglect, you know, very classic child welfare stuff. And then the second one, I consider the more typical mainstream critique of homeschooling. It's like, but will they learn everything they need to learn? Will they be socialized? Mm-hmm. Will they be responsible citizens? And so the conference was largely went down these two tracks. And in the end, I think there was much more unanimous concern about the child welfare stuff, the maltreatment stuff, than there was much more disagreement about the need for, you know, heavy-handed regulation to ensure educational or civic outcomes. Also, mm-hmm. everyone in this conference are totally committed believers in the ideals of public schools, and they believe right. in the potential of meaningful public school reform. And it was said over and over again by many different participants, you know, we should be focusing on making the public schools even better, so that homeschoolers, you know, there are fewer people who even feel the need to homeschool. And so this, mm-hmm. this ideal is very strong within the group that was attending this summit. So let me just quickly talk about like the main concerns regarding child welfare and then the educational civic stuff. And then I'll talk about the concrete suggestions that they put forth. So for child welfare, we're talking about like torture, physical abuse, sexual abuse, food deprivation, physical confinement, medical neglect. That was the very high level stuff. This is the kind mm-hmm. of stuff that the CRHE, Coalition for Responsible Home Education, reports on. And they like aggregate, you know, every once in a while you'll see these stories of horrible things happening to families that were legally homeschooled or, you know, kids that were in legally homeschooling families. And they aggregate all this stuff. And it, even though they can't really show that that this stuff happens at a higher rate statistically among homeschoolers than it does mm-hmm. any other kid, you know, they're still, and I think, you know, rightfully concerned that that this stuff can happen at all, that that a kid can be like locked in their room and, you know, only fed rice. I think that was one of the stories that mm-hmm. came out. And it's pretty horrific stuff. They're also concerned about labor trafficking. So sort of like with Tara Westover and educated kind of, you know, parents forcing mm-hmm. their kids to do manual labor for the family, gender-based discrimination, mm-hmm. religious indoctrination, and just all flavors of parental domination. Something that mm-hmm. stood out to me as a specific example in this summit was that some parents may hold important documents hostage to prevent a kid from leaving, like especially a teenager from leaving, like holding the birth certificate hostage or not filling out a FAFSA form so the kid can get you know, student loans to mm-hmm. go to college. And we heard from two grown homeschoolers who both came from like big families that were very religious. You know, they were both females. They were encouraged to marry early, to not go to college. There was a clear flavor of like parental dominance and child submission and parents that seem to have been radicalized by various books and or by religious oriented homeschooling groups. And something that really stood out to me, that one of them said was, the possible benefits to a few children who are homeschooled is not worth the loss to all the other homeschooling alumni. And so that was a very clear statement that that this person thinks that because there are some kids who are, you know, really sheltered and abused and they're, you know, all these doors are closed off to them, you know, watching out for the welfare of this small group of kids is more important than the benefits that come to all these other homeschoolers who are doing just fine. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the crux of the moral argument here regarding mm-hmm. child welfare. And then for academic and social development, this is stuff that I think we've heard and you and I have already talked about in the last episode, Pat, but the idea is parents should have, you know, minimum credentials. They should be able to prove that they can be effective, competent teachers. There was a very big, clear focus on the concept of teaching over learning here. Like
yes,
this classic.
I made a note to that effect too.
Yeah, this classic idea that homeschooling means parents are teachers, not, you know, kids are empowered learners.
There really did seem to be, a real misunderstanding among a lot of the folks in this in the second conference about, you know, how homeschooling operates on a daily basis for a lot of people.
I agree. It was pretty clear that there was not much direct exposure to homeschoolers, or if there was, it was probably very brief. And you know, mm-hmm. they had Milton Gaither and Robert Kuntzman on there, who are these two researchers who also mm-hmm. appeared in the post-pandemic conference, and they did the big review paper on the outcomes of homeschooling. And they essentially said, you know, regarding educational, social, and civic outcomes, you pretty much don't have to worry. It's kind of equal between mm-hmm. homeschoolers and non-homeschooled kids, or there's not enough evidence to make a meaningful conclusion.
Right.
So mm-hmm. that was a bit of a something that didn't really add up. It's like they said, well, we don't really have to worry about this stuff. And then Jim Dwyer and Elizabeth Barthollet went on and said, well, and here are all the very significant changes we need to make to ensure that they're not educationally deprived or unsocialized.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. So those were the two main threads of this conference. So before we start talking about their proposed regulations, like the concrete changes that were thrown out here, and this is what I appreciated about this summit, Pat, is that it really felt like the gloves came off, and in this little group of people who are all, you know, centered around the pillar of child welfare, you know, there were some pretty stringent policy proposals put on the table for regulating homeschooling. But let's go back to just the two broad concerns for child welfare and for educational, social, and civic outcomes. How do you feel about these concerns? Do you feel like they're warranted? Do you feel like they're reasonable?
Well, child welfare is certainly, absolutely a topic that we need to address and of concern. And I'm glad that the group is looking at that. This idea of, will they be good citizens? I mean, the research, as you said, like Kunzman and Gaffer presented their research and showed it, and you know, other I've seen this addressed in many different ways over the years. That seems to me to almost be a red herring. Well, it is a red herring, I'll say it. I mean, why, you know, it's like, why do they point out, I mean, that, you know, there's this level of ignorance about civic duty among homeschoolers as compared to people who go to public school. And a couple of them, or one of them, I'm looking through your notes real quick, cited January 6th insurrection, you know, Trump's big lie. And, you know, and I was just kind of thinking, I said, wait a minute, I'll bet you if you surveyed that crowd, three quarters of them are public school or private school graduates as opposed to homeschoolers. I'd even be surprised if it was a quarter of them were homeschooled. So where are you getting all this evidence that just going to school and graduating from a public school makes you a good citizen? You know, I mean, you know, right now, you know, what is it? Four out of there's a huge number of people who believe that, you know, QAnon, you know, I mean, and they're all, you know, public school graduates, and not all just a bunch of homeschoolers from rural areas or something like that. This is, you know,
yeah, we don't know. We presume that, but I share that presumption.
It seems very selective to me the way they threw it out there. And the other thing is that, and this comes up in patches throughout, and then towards the end, when the guy from Columbia Teachers College and the NEA guy come in, you know, the talk about, you know, schools need school reform. But wait a minute, you know, if you study, you know, the history of homeschooling, you'll realize that there's this person, John Holt, who was a very active school reformer in the 60s and 70s. And he actually gave up on school reform, saying, take your kids out because they're not serious. They're just, yeah, you know, and John's not the only one. He's the one that came up with a different solution. But people like Herb Kohl and Jonathan Kozol, I mean, they kept cursing the schools while they kept trying to reform them. And they haven't gotten any better. In fact, they've gotten more schoolish. They've gotten more, there's longer hours, more tests, more penalties, you know, for not learning what you're supposed to learn in school. How can they say that we should stop homeschooling today in order to make public schools better tomorrow?
And as you know, my gateway into this world was John Taylor Gatto, who tried really hard to do cool things in public schools, had some successes, but a lot of failures, and won all the awards, and then decided to hell with this. I'm going to quit, and I'm going to go start promoting all of these small-scale alternatives. He was a big fan of Sudbury schools, big fan of homeschooling and unschooling. You know, he never said, you know, defund the public schools, but he was a fan of the idea of putting a sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, market pressure onto public schools by saying we should, you know, let kids opt out, and this will force the public schools to get better. And I see that as an equally plausible idea for improving public schools. This is why the whole charter school thing is a hornet's nest. But I do think that in general, if kids are allowed to go to non-mainstream public schools, then that can be a force for good, ultimately, on those public schools. It's kind of like the, you know, tough love, shape up or ship out.
One of the things that really just keeps leaping out of me as I read, because you know, it's your single space, go on, I don't know how many pages, but it's quite a few. And, you know, really, they go into a lot of detail at this event about, like, new laws, new ways, you know, mandatory visits, twice a year evaluations, all sorts of proposals like that. And, you know, and every now and then, you know, you'll see somebody say, like, well, why not make the schools more welcoming of homeschoolers? You know, I mean, that's my first thought. If you want to get the kid, if you want to see homeschoolers and, you know, have them in under the eyes of mandatory reporters, make the schools more inviting to homeschoolers. And all these places for 40 years, they've had the same platform. No, we don't want anything to do with homeschoolers. You're either in or out. You're a danger to public schools and to society. You know, we've been hearing that over and over. But, you know, here in Massachusetts, and I know that this is a thing that Jim Dwyer and those guys wouldn't like because it's local control. You know, each local school district, you know, deals with it. So we had a friendly superintendent who let our daughter take Spanish class in the local public school, even though she was not counted in the average daily attendance formula. They didn't get extra money for her or anything. His attitude was, she's a student in my school district and I'm happy to help her learn.
Yeah.
And what's the problem?
Something that I liked was that there was a couple of different representatives from the CRHE. And while I feel like they sometimes go overboard with their suggested regulations as sort of reacting to what seems to be the you know, collective trauma of all these grown homeschoolers who came from these fairly repressive, you know, religious environments. One thing that they did bring up was this Alaska study and just the whole idea of the approach of the state of Alaska, which is to offer a financial incentive for homeschoolers to sort of have some minimal participation in the public school system. And that they presented that as a win-win. And they also had this very interesting study, which I've not gone into depth yet, but it showed that actually the more underprivileged homeschoolers, right? They called them correspondence students, but homeschoolers in Alaska were actually the ones who made the greatest gains. And that, I mean, that's a very compelling argument right there. And so Alaska seems like an interesting model to pay attention to in terms of, making, you know, public school resources more attractive. So you can still homeschool on your own, or you can homeschool with a little extra money and you'll be seen by a mandatory reporter on some regular basis, but you're still largely allowed to do your own thing. I agree that's a much more appealing direction to go if we have to talk about significant reforms than the more heavy-handed stuff that was presented in this summit. Yeah.
And then the other thing that kind of went by the wayside here, I think Jim Dwyer mentioned it, or someone, but it only got mentioned once, is this idea of, you know, if checking criminal records and seeing if someone has, you know, has a record of child abuse. And Bartholet mentions it too, now that I think out loud and looking at your notes here. But, you know, the argument against that is that I've heard from many parents or adults who've had run-ins with the system is that there's, ex-wives who have or husbands who have access to grind can report you to the CPS, the Child Protective Services, or, you know, just a subtle grudge. There's a lot of misinformation in these records, blah, blah, blah. So let's fix them. let's make the system work. It's there, you know.
I mean, Child Protective System?
The reporting system, so that you know you can look back and say, oh, this person has no history of child abuse, has never had any criminal activity, and so on. Of course, and then even then it should be judged on a case by case basis. Like if it was for shoplifting a pack of gum, Come on.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Why would that prevent you from teaching your child at home?
So this is a good time. I summarized all of the concrete proposals that were put forth in this summit. And so these are all from different people. If you want to know exactly who said what, you can go read through the notes. But mm-hmm. here are some of the concrete proposals regarding the child welfare stuff, the maltreatment and abuse. So there's a bunch of child protective services related suggestions. I know very little about child protective services. And so just as a caveat, let's mm-hmm. see, one suggestion was that if there are families with previous child protective service cases that then suddenly disenroll their kid from school, that should lead to some sort of mandatory CPS contact, because apparently that's the big main indicator of something horrible is about to happen, which is a lot of previous contact with child protective services, and then a family decides to pull their kid out of school. That seems mm-hmm. to be an established pattern. Mm-hmm. Others said, you know, you can't homeschool if you have a pending child protective services report. That seems like a type of situation where, like, the ex with a grudge could really use this to wield it over you, as mm-hmm. you just mentioned, Pat. Mm-hmm. Periodic check-ins, like every 30, 60, 90 days after a CPS case closes. If there's a substantiated finding of abuse or neglect, the family shouldn't be allowed to homeschool at all. I think that's Barthelet's suggestion.
Yep.
If a child mm-hmm. or a sibling has a founded report of abuse or neglect in the past 18 months, the family can still homeschool, but they have to be monitored by a child welfare agency for between 6 to 24 months. So this is a lot of talk of, yeah, child protective services getting really involved in mm-hmm. in the lives of families. Mm-hmm. There's other suggestions for registration. I found these interesting in the sense that I didn't realize that we don't have anything like this in the United States. But essentially, the suggestion was there should be some sort of registration of kids, like beyond a birth certificate, either at birth or maybe starting at age 5. And essentially, a kid gets a tracking number. And so every kid has sort of like a student ID number that follows them. And this is a way in which kids could never fall between the cracks. And you know that a kid is either in public school or private school or is supposed to be homeschooled. And so they can be checked in with. What do you think, Pat? Like, on one hand, this is very Big Brother-ish. On the other hand, what we heard from the post-pandemic conference was like, well, the most basic thing we need to do is just have all homeschoolers register so we actually know that they exist.
Well, you know, the devil's in the details. The general idea is good. You know, I think every child should be recognized, but I'm not crazy at all about the idea for the Big Brother-ish ideas that you put forth about, you know, the idea of giving them a special number when they're 5 and it's going to follow them.
I mean, they're supposed to have social security numbers already.
I was going to say, that was my next thought is like, why do we have to keep adding layers and layers of bureaucracy on top of this issue? You know, it's like, let's figure out like the tools we have now, make them sharper and work properly. And why not use someone's social security number? Have they been so badly compromised? I don't know. I mean, I've had mine stolen and someone filed a tax return under my name 1 year. So, you know, and then look at a vaccine, you know, the vaccine cards, right? The debate going on right now. This is one of the things that really kind of surprised me overall about the notes. It's like, you know, these lawyers, yeah, they work at, you know, Ivy League elite schools and they're well-trained and super smart. But what about the states? You know, I mean, they act like we're just going to pass this federal law. It's going to cut, you know, it's going to cut through. And it's just like growing up in the homeschooling movement in the 80s, I can't tell you how many times I heard this is a states' rights issue. Made me look it up. And then, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement, I realized even more like how states' rights is tied to slavery and goes all the way back to that, mm-hmm. you know. And so it's a very thorny issue, but the idea that they're just going to flat out have a federal law that can do this, that's very aspirational thinking.
Yeah. In the end, when they talked about specific litigation strategies, there was a big focus on amending state constitutions instead of federal level policy. There seems to be mm-hmm. hope that the positive right to an education, however defined, is much more likely to be enacted at the state level. So just going on with the specific prescriptions for dealing with abuse, we've already discussed this, but seeing outside adults. So it could look like mm-hmm. mandated visits to pediatricians on an annual or semi-annual basis. One person suggested an annual assessment by a therapist or other health provider to sort of assess mental health. And one interesting suggestion was that we should make more people mandatory reporters, including midwives, because, the types of families who are going to be off the grid are also not participating in the mainstream healthcare system, and they're doing home births. And so if we make midwives mandatory reporters, then they will, I don't know what the idea here is. Like,
yeah, I mean,
it doesn't seem very feasible to me.
Even school age kids.
Yeah. What? While they're giving birth to a kid, they're just going to notice that there's a malnourished 8-year-old in the corner like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you so distracted while you're delivering a baby?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, getting children more, and again, this, I know there's an idea that John Holt put forth many times, but he wasn't the only one. And back in history, children were part of adult society. We put them in the educational silo at the turn of the late 19th century, and we've built a bigger silo since then to keep more and more kids in. Let's get them out of the silo. Let's get them more exposed. Let's get them in the community so that they have more interactions. More people will know them.
And to the credit of many people in this conference, they said the stuff that we're proposing is stuff that most like good homeschooling families already do.
Their kids see
pediatricians, their kids see outside adults and participate and socialize with other kids. And I'm like, yeah. That's right. And, we're all just acting on this presumption that because we don't have total information about the number of homeschoolers out there, that there theoretically could be this large shadowy subset of highly confined, abused, and neglected kids. When we go out there and we actually talk to people who are homeschooling, by and large, and the people in the summit recognize this, these kids are fine. They're healthy. They're within the normal spectrum of behavior and competence. So
yeah. And then the issue of chores. I mean, you mentioned early on in the conversation how they're saying about child labor, but if you live in a farm, what's the problem? Yeah, you help feed the chickens. You help do stuff. There was an article. I think I mentioned this. I don't know if it was to you or somebody else, but there was an article in the New York Times maybe a month ago, where it was an advice column for parents saying, is it okay to let your kids do chores? And they asked all these psychiatrists and child counselors, is it okay? And of course, most of them said yes, of course, because it gives children a sense of self-efficacy. And it's like, do we really need the permission of somebody to help say it's okay for my child to help me wash the dishes?
Yeah.
And again, it shows a general misunderstanding of how all this works, because I was not homeschooled, but I remember wanting to help around the house. I wanted to use the lawnmower. I wanted to help cook.
And what John Taylor Gatto said is, if kids don't feel useful, then they feel useless. And if we're considering,
he had a great turn of phrase, didn't he?
he really did. My other favorite John Gattoism was, genius is as common as dirt. I love that. So, if we just keep as our default assumption that kids do want to participate in society and they want to be part of communities because that's where virtually everyone derives a sense of meaning, then that means that they do want to participate. They do want to do stuff. Not all work is oppressive. I think what people are concerned about when it comes to labor trafficking is, forcing a kid to do 12 hours of handicraft when the kid really wants to be, watching YouTube videos about skateboarding or learning French or, you know, something like that.
Right. Or like, you know, and I've described in educated, you know, making them do difficult work, dangerous work. Yeah, like
dangerous work in your dad's junkyard.
Yeah, without any proper safety mechanisms. Yeah, I mean, but that would be true regardless of whether homeschooling or not, you know, if they had adult employees in that situation, you know.
And that's another thing that was conceded in this summit, especially by Berthelet, was that parents still have a ton of time with their kids, regardless of whether they're homeschooled or they go to school. They still have a lot of time to influence their kids and to do all, you know, these extracurricular activities. And so, okay, but then I can already hear.
But what they don't understand is that some parents enjoy being with their children and watching and helping them learn. It's as simple as that.
I don't think that's lost on them. They're just concerned about this nefarious subset of parents who are radicalized, who really want to dominate their kids.
That gets really difficult because, you know, the whole issue, I'm sorry, but the whole issue of like, you know, not letting a daughter go to college because a daughter has to be a wife.
Yeah.
Right. That's their religious belief. Well, you know, the Amish in a couple of court cases, you know, Yoder versus Wisconsin, I think, anyway, you know, they said, yeah, you know, you're a religious community and you know, you can live the way you need to live, you know, and, you know, but then, you know, we're stuck in America and not stuck, but we live in America and, you know, there are certain rights that you're supposed to have. And, you know, I think young ladies and men should have the choice and do have the choice of deciding what they want to do, particularly after they reach the, what am I going to say, 16 or 18? I guess it's 18 now, you know? So, you know, what do you do? You know, are we just going to flip over all those laws, you know, about that do grant special permission to religious communities?
The issue of religion is so tied up in all of this. And a lot of the barriers to legal change, as reported by the lawyers that were in this summit, are directly connected to, you know, protection from religious persecution and from being singled out because of your religious influence lifestyle. And that's a very American thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
One thing that Berthelet said, which I appreciated, was that her aim is to just make sure that every kid has a minimum exposure to other viewpoints and gains basic skills to function in the world. Like when it's phrased like that, I'm like, yeah, I agree with you.
Right.
It's just that then her concrete proposals tend to go way overboard for me.
They're very schoolish. Put them in a class and into a public school where they will meet people with different viewpoints. Well, what about, you know, 4-H? What about, you know, getting the, you know, creating clubs that do have deliberately have.
So,
A makeup of different people.
That's part of Jim Dwyer's propositions. In addition to having parents have a minimum credential level and to have a plan for, you know, to his credit, he's like, we shouldn't require just like traditional academic subjects to be covered because public school is not a great kind of waypoint, you know, a great standard to follow. They should be given a lot of flexibility in their approach, but still he wants a clear plan for learning and teaching. He also wants like a written plan for socialization. And that's an interesting concept because in one way it just feels very bureaucratic and it's in the same way that parents get around these sort of draconian homeschool regulations today. I can imagine that happening in the future, but if you did have to acquiesce to that sort of requirement, you could say, yeah, my kid's going to go to 4-H and my kid's going to do this homeschool class. Again, this is what most homeschooling and unschooling families are already doing.
Right.
Let me just finish with the concrete proposals for addressing neglect, Pat. So
sure.
Screening parents, screen proposed homeschoolers for any civil or criminal child abuse history. And be on the lookout for repeated offenders, because again, that seems to be directly linked to, you know, really bad things are about to happen. Mm-hmm. And then oversight, you know, Elizabeth Barthelet wants home visits by CPS, and she recognizes that's probably not going to fly. And so other people say, well, you know, the kids should be monitored, but it probably shouldn't be in the home. And so the idea that a lot of people seem to coalesce around was that you can require homeschoolers to attend at least some public school courses and extracurricular activities. And Barthelet even said that she believes this is the single best protection and the single best reform that could be enacted. And in her mind, this is going to public school like once a week, although she did say, or even daily. Excuse me, daily. So going to, let's go with once a week here, where they can be seen by mandatory reporters and develop trust and relationship with teachers. And this all is consistent with her idea that if a kid is seen by non-parental adults who are mandatory reporters on a regular basis, then that minimizes the chance of the worst kind of abuses being perpetrated. And there was a good amount of discussion about, like, well, why are we trying to reform homeschooling when there's very few laws on the books about private schools? Like, won't these homeschoolers just then go enroll in some unregulated mm-hmm. private school? And Barthelet responded to that as a question and said, well, yes, that's still concerning, but at least then they'll be seen by these non-parental adults. So this is really her big concern, and that is her big desire. How does that sit with you, Pat? And have you heard this suggestion be made before, that homeschoolers should be forced to attend some public school?
Oh yeah, I have. And for, you know, the idea that, you know, my understanding of the compulsory school law is that, you know, you can be educated otherwise. It's not like there's only one way to do it, which is why we allow private schools. And I do think that that's a valid and something that really needs to be looked at, that if you're going to ban homeschooling, then you're effectively banning private schools. And, you know, you should really, you know, take a look at that. And, and frankly, I'm not even sure that Barthelet's reasoning is all that sound in terms of private schools, because religious schools only want people of the same religion and so on. So wouldn't there be a uniformity of opinion and stuff as to what switch to use to discipline the student body, and, you know, how we should shun certain students, you know, who exhibit certain behavior. I mean, it's not going to prevent it, you know, people from forming such things, you know. I appreciate the, again, like, you know, that we need to protect children, you know, and we need to help them learn. But we don't necessarily do that by forcing them to go to school or a mandatory reporter's office. You know, I mean, it should be more flowing with life, like, and having more experiences where children and adults can interact, and more, there will be more eyes on the child. And I think that would be a much better approach, you know, to just figure out other ways and places for children to be besides school for those who don't want to be there. And we're seeing it with learning centers, places like, well, you know where I'm going.
Like liberated learner centers, agile learning centers.
All the alternatives to school that are slowly emerging. You know, I wish they would come out stronger. And who knows, maybe the pandemic will drive a demand for it, you know, the post-pandemic. But, and I hope it does. But at the same time, you know, children need to be raised by somebody, you know. And I think that we want to keep them with their families as much as possible. And families need a break. You know, it's been tough. I mean, you know, incomes are low. It's been very hard because the cost of college and the cost of education overall has risen. It costs $1,000 a month on average if you want to send your kids to private school now. Oof. So, yeah, you know, we need more options. And, you know, in schooling, as Jim Dwyer points out, and I have to say, like, of all the proposals, you know, and again, he gave a really detailed presentation in his book, Homeschooling, the History and Philosophy of a Controversial Practice, you know, and I certainly have reservations about some of his proposals, but I think that he's at least making a fair and balanced effort of trying to
figure out. I agree.
And what this issue is.
If you're listening and you want to get deeper into this, definitely read that book. And there's a lot to disagree with. There's a lot where it still feels like it's overreaching, because even his minimal reform suggestions would be way more restrictive than the most maximally restrictive, like the state of New York right now. It's definitely moving in the direction of European levels of homeschooling regulation, but you can just sense, you know, the sort of respect for the individualization, the, as you said, Pat, the sort of, you know, going with the flow, honoring the parent-child relationship. And he just doesn't come off as having this, almost like, you know, public school true believer, missionary feeling that Barthollet often presents.
Right, and many of the other people, the NEA guy, and
of course
some other people, you know, they're all over, like, you know, make them go to school, make it more like school. But there was one. I'm looking for this comment that you highlighted from the chat. I think I know.
Is it from Emily Putnam Hornstein?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I was actually about to read this.
Bring that up.
Yeah. So she is not a homeschooling specific researcher. She focuses on child abuse and neglect. And there was a couple things she said in the discussion. She said, the first thing was, I appreciate all these ideas and solutions, but none of them feel practical or realistic. I think we're making the mistake of trying to reform the entire educational system, then trying to identify a relatively small subset of families who should not be able to homeschool. Yeah. Amen. And then she goes on to say, you know, sorry for being a broken record, but I think this is a flawed strategy. Families across the political spectrum are disillusioned by how the teachers' unions and public schools have met the needs of children during the last year, and the entire notion that public school meets the needs of children is being questioned. It's not about gang-ridden schools. This is about your average parent who cares about education. I'm sort of rapidly summarizing her comment here. So I'm just not understanding what the strategy is. We should not be attacking homeschooling. We should be advocating for reasonable restrictions as to who can homeschool. And so I really like that. I underlined that sentence
and wrote yes.
Yeah. She has a laser focus on what I think is the legitimate concern of this summit, which is this very small, very, I think it's an extremely small subset of families who are committing these atrocities and using homeschooling laws as a cover. Like, there should be surgical precision here. If you're going to do any reforms, it should only be targeted at preventing those extreme cases and doing minimal collateral damage to all the other homeschooling families along the way.
Yeah. I always remember when John Holt, you know, saying hard cases make bad law.
Oh, well done, John Holt.
Yeah, right. And you know, these are hard cases, but you can't to generalize that, as you and I discussed. You know, I keep coming up with even more contradictions and issues, like, wow, especially when you get into the religious end of it. Yeah.
So, I could go on and summarize all of the suggestions for like the educational and social and civic reforms, but this is stuff you've heard before. It's, you know, you got to have evaluation, mandatory public school enrollment.
Yeah. One thing that came, you know, I'm looking through my notes here at the very end of all the notes I wrote. Why isn't banning corporal punishment considered?
Can you explain that? I'm not sure where you're going with that.
Well, the UK and many countries have banned corporal punishment of children, you know, in schools and out of schools.
Okay.
It's just not correct, socially correct, to beat children.
Okay. I don't know anything about this. Go on.
You know, and so I would like to know more why they feel that, because, you know, 19 states allow corporal punishment in schools. It's on the books. You can use a paddle to hit a kid in the school. You know, why can't we ban that? And then, of course, we know that, you know, in the conservative Christian community, you know, goodness, there are books on Amazon by the Pearl family, I believe they're called.
There was a lot of discussion about that in the summit, how there's like clear literature out there for like how to hit kids without leaving bruises. This strategy of total domination.
Yeah. So it's just like, come on. I mean, while we may not be able to ban, you know, religious practices that make women subservient to men, at the same time, we can certainly ban corporal punishment because that's physical damage. That's plainly against the law, you know?
And something that Jim Dwyer led with in this conference was the idea that, you know, we don't think it's appropriate to give any person, any human being, total control over the life of another human being. You know, that is what is potentially enabled by, you know, lack of any form of meaningful oversight of homeschooling in terms of parents being able to do that with their kids. You know, I continue to appreciate where he's coming from. He's coming from a very like child-centered, like children are people too, approach, and what you're talking about with you know, banning corporal punishment. I do feel like a lot of these people are coming from this good place of saying like, we need some meaningful way to at least know if a kid is being horrifically abused, you know, just that when you have to speak up for these voiceless people.
Right. But it's a shame that their solution is always then to put it in some like impersonal situation, like a school or an orphanage. Our group home.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we have to come up with better ideas here, you know, and solutions than that, you know, because we know that they're not working as well, you know.
But one of the litigators who was discussing strategy on the third day of the summit said something that stuck out to me. And I want to get your take on this, Pat. He said, the successful homeschoolers, i.e. the privileged and middle-class ones, are defending the system of non-regulation that leads to abuse. We need to call out these people. I'm pretty sure he's talking about the types of homeschoolers that you and I know a lot of, and we have formed our impressions of homeschooling based upon. Do you feel like you are complicit part of defending this system of non-regulation that leads to abuse? Is there blood on your hands, Pat? Is there blood on my hands?
Well, I've certainly protested certain regulations. I live in a state that has some regulation, you know, that has regulations, you know, so, you know, and I'm comfortable with them, you know, so I, you know, but the idea that just having a regulation is going to make something better, and that regulation is just to put the kid in school. That's where I think a lot of people are, you know, particularly middle class, privileged, as you put it, successful homeschoolers, would wonder, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, successful, I'm looking at your note here, defending the system of non-regulation that leads to abuse. We need to call out these people. What is he, you know, he wants to dox people who say that homeschooling should not be regulated. You know, at some point when does regulation of homeschooling start and regulation of parenting begin? You know, then it becomes that line. And it really becomes, you know, this is where it gets so broad. Like, again, like just getting back to a very specific thing. How do we prevent, you know, how did that woman put it?
Essentially the most egregious cases.
Reasonable. Yeah. Yeah. How do we advocate hard for reasonable restrictions as to who can homeschool? Reasonable restrictions of who can homeschool. That makes a lot more sense to me than these, you know, these really broad, you know, let's call out all these middle-class people who support non-regulation. You know,
so maybe we can wrap up on a note of like, what would be, if we had to accept some level of reform, you know, what would be this minimal kind of surgical strike type of reform that would do the least damage to those families that are successfully homeschooling or even struggling with homeschooling, but will eventually become successful while, you know, hopefully mitigating the worst harm to those kids who are being homeschooled as a cover. Like, I'll go first, Pat, and then okay. You can tell me what you're thinking. What seemed clear from the presentations on child abuse was that if a family has had multiple CPS cases and reports brought against them, that there's this trend that if they then pull their kids out of school, then you know, then like you find the kid chained to the radiator or not fed for weeks or whatever, mm-hmm. Beaten. So that seems like a pretty reasonable threshold. Like if you have been reported multiple times already, and then you are trying to go underground so that you can no longer be reported, you know, mm-hmm. I could see a case for heightened state involvement with those families. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that would threaten the vast majority of families who are totally responsible and have nothing to do with Child Protective Services.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I think the background mm-hmm. checks, I don't know why these are so vociferously fought against. It doesn't make sense to me. This seems like a fairly common sense proposal. But you said, it shouldn't be tied to minor infractions. It should be like, all right, if you already have a criminal history of being
right.
some sort of abuser, then yeah, I don't yeah. know. Should you, maybe you yeah. should never be allowed to homeschool. Maybe there should be some time period you have to wait. I don't know. That yeah. seems reasonable to me also. And that's not going to affect the vast majority of people and make it so that it's, mm-hmm. it you can't use it as this bludgeoning tool that like, yeah, one ex-spouse can use to prevent, you know, their ex from homeschooling.
Yeah, I know. Like, you know, I'm going to teach magic in a YMCA summer camp this summer. And, you know, I've got to have a query done on me, which I've done before. Background check. I've taught after school programs of yeah. magic again.
I do that when I hire trip leaders for Unschool Adventures trips. Yeah, exactly. We do a national background check. Of course.
Yeah, yeah. And but at the same time, I've heard people, particularly people who have been incarcerated, saying that the quarry system is really bad because it prevents them from getting work after they've served their sentences. And,
yeah.
you know, there's a lot of bad data in there. So, yeah, but again, like I said, right at the top, let's clean it up. Let's take our existing tools and make them work instead yeah. of just keep them in place and add another layer of bureaucracy.
Yeah, like the social security numbers. I agree. So, yeah. And the last thing that I feel like I can get behind is if you're going to have to require homeschoolers to see some sort of outside adult who is a mandated reporter, then, you know, what's the type of person that they're probably already going to be seeing anyways, like a pediatrician, a doctor, mm-hmm. if you mandated that, you know, once a year, a homeschool, you know, a pediatrician has to see a homeschooler to just report that there's no like bruises mm-hmm. on their body. You know, mm-hmm. that seems very non-invasive to me. This whole idea of like assessment by a therapist, geez, that sounds very Clockwork Orange. I don't think
and,
so.
And the other thing, just to throw this out though, is like a lot, and I believe someone raised this actually in your notes. Not everyone can afford an annual visit. I mean,
I know this is so tied to like other issues of like who pays for healthcare.
Yeah.
I agree.
And again, like you know, everyone wants to separate the issue out, just make it about education. And you know, and it's just like, but it's, you know, you're talking about children and families and society here. That's what John realized. He started off as, you know, reforming his classroom. And he says, no, all we have to do is reform the world, reform society to make this work.
Yeah. Easy.
Yeah. So, right. Exactly.
those are the concrete ideas that I feel like I would have a hard time, you know, speaking out mm-hmm. against. And, yeah. and so, there was a lot of discussion about the HSLDA in this summit, mm-hmm. also, and how they, you know, will not move an inch when it comes to any perceived regulation or increased oversight of homeschooling. And I feel like that's mm-hmm. a mistake. I feel like there are some very basic like protections that can be enacted mm-hmm. that will not negatively harm the vast majority of people out there. And so there mm-hmm. is some sort of middle ground that can be found.
Right.
Okay. So enough for me. What do you think, Pat? What are the concrete changes that you would back?
Well, again, at going after corporal punishment, you know, making a law saying, you know, it should be banned, allowing children to homeschool children to take public school classes, you know, not mandating it, but, you know, lure them in, you know, put some attractive classes in there, put a good teacher in there, whatever, you know. But, you know, that would be another way. I'm all for public health, you know, and so if, you know, having the government, you know, having our taxes paid to make sure that, you know, families can use the doctors of their choice, you know, depending on what, you know, if they're into alternative medicine or regular doctors, but they're all mandatory reporters, I hope. And that would take care of that to a degree. But I don't think any of this is really going to solve the whole problem until we start to give children the respect and dignity that they lack, you know. John wrote about this a lot, about, you know, you just listen to the interactions of parents and teachers, you know, the way that they yell and scream at kids, you know, and, you know, force them and bribe them and threaten them. I mean, you know, changing those behaviors, you know, and, you know, through modeling, I personally, I would love to see, like, you know, public service announcements that say children not born to be hit, you know, mm-hmm. it's, you know, you cause more damage to a child by hitting them than, you know, that discipline can be done in, you know, can be learned in other ways, mm-hmm. you know, but we don't want to do those sorts of things. You know, I don't know. America's very funny that way. You know, we prize personal and individuality and, self-reliance, and I'm all for that. But at the same time, we live in a community. We're not individuals alone. We're individuals in a crowd. And then, you know, we should interact with the people in that crowd and get to know them better. And trying to figure out how to do that, you know, I mean, school alleges to do it, but it's clearly not working and hasn't. This is the thing that annoys me the most is, you know, I'm 64 and I've been through at least three major school reforms led by the federal government, and God knows how many here in the state of Massachusetts. And, you know, all they've done is up the graduation rates a bit. Still doesn't mean that people are working well, getting good jobs, healthcare and all that stuff. You know, I mean, there's a disconnect that I think that we really have to start to put back together in society. Mm. And to just focus on, like, as you put it, you know, a subset of homeschoolers who, you know, for religious or political or just, you know, bad reasons that, you know, strange ideas that they have of family unity, you know, lead them to abuse their children, you know, in either by educational neglect or physical neglect, whatever, you know. But again, just sending the kid to school doesn't solve that problem. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have to really deal with this on a meta level instead of just saying, oh, let's pass a law that'll do this and that'll solve that problem. Let's have them go look at this doctor once a year and that'll take care of that problem.
Yeah, and just to bring it back to John Taylor Gatto once again, the sense that I got from this summit was that, you know, we can't give up on the public school ideal. And it's really like this Santa Claus figure, which is going to distribute gifts to all the kids. And, you know, if we mm-hmm. can only just figure out the right way to tweak it and make it perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, John Gatto wrote, listen, we've tried for a long time. You know, there are some very foundational problems with the notion of public school, and the analogy that he drew that I always come back to. He says, what's the difference between public schools and public parks and or public libraries? So we don't have a bunch of uproar over parks and libraries. We all happily fund these things. The difference is you don't compel anyone to go to a park or a library. It's as basic as that. It's about this basic form of choice, of non-coercion, making resources available but not mandatory. And he really spoke out for this kind of unique American individualistic approach of letting lots of little experiments flourish. And and I think that that has to be preserved. And the people in the summit, by and large, you know, want to move the education system towards a more European, more social welfare model. And I can see where they're coming from. And earlier, Pat, you said, you know, this is about treating children with dignity and respect. And I feel like they share that exact same goal. This is about making sure all these kids have dignity and respect. They are just putting more faith in this imperfect institution than they're putting in largely decentralized all the way down to the level of the individual family, you know, a multitude of solutions. And anytime there's a multitude of solutions, there's going to be a few wackos at the end of the distribution. But then you look at the opposite end of the distribution, and there are these wonderful, glorious success stories that go so far beyond what conventional school could have ever offered. And so it's like, what kind of world do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a world where these sort of glorious outliers are possible, or where everything, maybe in a sort of Finland model, is constrained into this one narrow band of like, all right, everything's pretty good or okay most of the time. And, you know, nothing's really allowed to be, we hope nothing's allowed to go really bad, but at the same time, there are so many guardrails that you can't do anything very different, very outside the box. You know, for me, I go for the more American approach, you know, but I'm biased, of course, and I haven't had direct exposure to the worst of the worst. I'm just hearing about this now. So, boy, what are we going to do?
Well, I hope that there can be some sort of discussion that prevents the masters of the universe who want to pull all the levers on the education machine to, you know, make this whole thing work, come to realize that maybe it'd be better if it was a more fluid and more small scale. A lot of small scale things. I mean, schools used to be that way. It used to be neighborhood schools and stuff. Now we've gone into the magnet school idea. And yeah, you know, in fact, one of the moderators during one of the sessions was talking about, you know, the data and the lack of data and how we need the data so we can manage homeschoolers. That just kind of made my eyes pop a little bit. It's like, wait, that's why you want all this data to manage us?
Yeah, this idea of everything being a resource or a widget.
Yeah. So I really wish that you know, we could get people who, you know, who understand that family life and raising children is not just about pulling levers and putting people in classes and classifying them. You know, so it's going to be hard, but at the same time, you know, children should not be beaten and they should not be denied educational opportunities. And, you know, this is serious. I mean, granted, it's a subset of homeschooling, but it should be, you know, we need to talk about it and figure it out. You know, I mean, it's not going to be easy, as you know, these high-powered individuals make clear. You know, I mean, they keep talking about, like, you know, how after they propose an idea, they say, yeah, but that's going to be a hard pull. You know, so it'll be interesting going forward to see what happens. But I think it's all going to break down at the state level, you know, not at the federal level on this, and that every state is going to, you know, like the Harvard advocates, you know, want to ban homeschooling, or now, you know, they've taken a more nuanced position, thank God. But, you know, I hope that they could realize that small is beautiful, and that maybe you know, they shouldn't like use the bulldozer to try and solve this problem, but a scalpel instead.
All right. That's a beautiful place to end it. Pat, thank you so much for diving into both of these conferences with me. And I love this discussion. So it's been a real treat.
Always a pleasure talking with you, Blake. Always.
Onwards.
Excelsior.